Principles of Economics, My Complete Guide to Understanding Economics, is now available in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook from SaifEddin.com, Amazon, and many more booksellers worldwide. And now, I am also teaching a course based on this book on my website, SaifEddin.com. Principles of Economics will run the whole academic year, from September to June, and will have a new lecture every 2 weeks, as well as weekly live online discussion seminars open to learners from all over the world and from all walks of life. Whether you're a student, a professional, or a retiree, you are making economic decisions every day, and this course will arm you with the wisdom of centuries of economists to improve your economic decision-making. You'll also get a free book of Principles of Economics if you sign up for the course. Go to SaifEddin.com and sign up now. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by Orange Pill App, the Bitcoin-only social network that connects you with high-signal Bitcoiners, events, and now merchants as well. If you're like me and can't stop talking about Bitcoin, you know how challenging it can be to talk to the no-coiners and how nice it is to talk to someone who gets you. With the Orange Pill app, you can find the Bitcoiners near you and they can replace the no-coiners in your life. You can organize events and meetups with local Bitcoiners, and wherever you travel, you can meet up with local Bitcoiners all while being as anonymous as you like. So if you want to build your local network of Bitcoiners, find a Bitcoin meetup or merchants accepting Bitcoin, head over to orangepillapp.com to sign up or download the app from the App Store or Google Play Store and send me a DM so we can get connected. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by CoinKite. CoinKite are my favorite makers of Bitcoin hardware. They produce the legendary OpenDime, the first Bitcoin bearer asset, as well as the reliable Cold Card hardware wallet, the excellent stainless steel seed plates for storing your seed phrases, and the block clock. Now, CoinKite have produced the Sats card, a card the size of a credit card which can store Bitcoin and works great as a gift. CoinKite have just produced a limited edition gorgeous Bitcoin Standard Sats card, which carries the Bitcoin Standard logo, and you can get it from coinkite.shop/Bitcoin Standard. Use the code Bitcoin Standard to get 5% off your purchase. This podcast is also brought to you by the Bitcoin Way, your professional Bitcoin IT team offering you personalized, secure, and comprehensive solutions for every step along your Bitcoin journey. The Bitcoin Way offer live concierge service to guide you with your Bitcoin cold storage, running your node, privacy best practices, inheritance planning, corporate strategy, and multi-sig solutions. They don't touch your coins, they guide you through the process of acquiring your coins and securing them. If you'd like to make your setup safer and more reliable, book a consult with them and see what they have to suggest. If you want to give someone the gift of Bitcoin, get them this professional service that will ensure they start off knowing exactly how to manage their coins and not lose them. Go to thebitcoinway.com and start Bitcoining more confidently.
Which is more on the theoretical side. I don't know if it's relevant, but I think there is a connection to all these things going on. Recently, we've been witnessing a change of the narrative, even among the people who are Bitcoin enthusiasts. Before, people used to say, well, it's risky, but it's worth the risk. Now, there's this whole talk about Bitcoin being the conservative investment. And then I began to think about this in terms of more theoretical discussions that go back to Hayek, even Mises, and people in the traditional markets like Eugene Fama and so on. So Hayek had that concept of knowledge being something distributed. Nobody really knows what is best for his business, for his life, for the world or anything, but it's the totality of partial and imperfect knowledge that in the end leads to what is best for the market. Eugene Fama, I'm sure you're familiar with, had this idea of markets being efficient because in the end, the information trickles down to everybody and so on, which I think it's crazy. We just look at stock markets and so on. And everything is manipulated. Could we say that Bitcoin brings efficiency to all the markets in the following sense? Because of course there's lots of stuff happening with companies and everything which we can't really know about, but all, if we are in a Bitcoin standard, if we're going towards the Bitcoin standard, then more and more those things are based upon the monetary basis of the Bitcoin protocol. And that is something that is very much known to everybody who wants to know about it, because it's in the blockchain, it's public, we have chain analysis and so on. So the decisions in the end, every agent in the market is going to decide upon something based on the little information he has. But crucial information about the monetary basis is there for everyone to see. So there is a sense in which Bitcoin brings efficiency to the market. Not like the way Eugene Fama said, but so in a sense, we can have more knowledge about everything than what Hayek was talking about. Am I too off the curve or something?
No, I think you're touching on something real in that. And it goes back to what I always like to dwell on, which is Bitcoin is the first constant in all of economics. Because without a constant, then that's really the problem with all calculation. Like all calculation in economics is essentially useless from the Austrian perspective, because there's no unit. So when you're talking about utility, or when you're talking about any kind of measure that is subjective, there's no way of measuring those things. There's no way of expressing them objectively, because a measure, you know, you need a unit, and the unit needs to be constant between anybody who's coming to contact with the unit. So when you buy a refrigerator, so you get it imported to Brazil from China, and it was designed in the US, let's say, the designers in the US and the Chinese manufacturers and the Brazilian importers and you as the end user all have a very precise and verifiable and replicable measure of what is an inch and what is a meter and what is a centimeter. And so when you order the fridge that is 2 meters high, there's not going to be any confusion about what exactly a meter is. Everybody involved in Brazil and in China and in the US and all the suppliers and everybody along the way knows exactly what the 2-meter fridge is. And there's not going to be any confusion with that. But the problem with economics and with a lot of the calculations that can be done with economics is that there's no constant. There's no measure that we can use to express things which can be clearly expressed for everybody and that is understood for everybody. So if you measure things in terms of their dollar value, well, the dollar itself is constantly oscillating and it's changing in value and it's changing in supply. And you never know when it might have a bad year or a good year, and when it can go up and when can it go down. So for making economic calculations based on, you know, you can't do economic calculations with the dollar with the same precision that you can do with the meter. You know exactly what a 2-meter fridge is like, but you don't know exactly what a $200 amount of money will get you. You know, today it gets you something, in 5 years, it'll get you something else, and it could be much, it could be smaller, it could be much smaller than what it gets you today. But you know it's going to be smaller, but you don't know by how much. So because of that, really, this is ultimately the problem with the mathematicization of economics. Beyond basic profit and loss calculations, which are done with money and are done for business entities that are examining money, beyond that, there's very little scope for measuring and calculating anything because there are no units. All economic decision making is done with utility. We think of the mental construct of utility, but we have no way of measuring it. And it's one of the funniest things in the mainstream economics textbook, how they kind of skip over the fact of the utility that they're discussing. Like the textbook just begins, gives you some calculations to do, run some numbers, come up with the answer, and then figure out how much does this guy value apples, or how many apples is he going to buy? And based on some numbers about his utility, but you know, you calculate the utility he gets from apples and the answer is 25, but then 25 what? It's a question they skip over in the textbook. You could express it as dollars. Sometimes they express it as dollars, that the utility can be measured as dollars, but sometimes they express it as utils. They invent a thing called util, which is the number of utilities that you get. And it's absolutely absurd to be putting this kind of construct. What is a util? You know, it's like, let's define height and length in terms of this new unit that I'm going to call lengthiness. Okay, so my fridge is two lengthinesses long. How long is your fridge? Well, my fridge can be 500 lengthinesses long because I define the lengthinessness unit differently from your unit. So you can see this is clearly a path for just insane communication. If we can't agree on terminology and we can't agree on measures, then we can't talk, we can't communicate. It becomes a waste of time. And that's kind of what most economics education is. We're running numbers on a unit that doesn't exist, and we're just assuming that we can come up with conclusions based on it. Now, when it comes to efficiency, I think the entire concept of efficiency in economics, in my mind, is just inapplicable. You can't really think about economics in terms of efficiency as I see it, because it's a concept taken from physics and from engineering in particular. And it's a concept that really has no equivalent in economics, because in engineering, when you're trying to measure the efficiency of an engine, there's a theoretical maximum amount of energy that you can get from the oil that goes into the engine. And then there's the actual energy that you get out of it, which is, so let's say that you put in gasoline into the car, and that gasoline, the amount of gasoline that you put in, if you burn it, it'll contain this many joules of energy that can be gotten from it. But that's not the amount of joules that's going to be translated into work by the car, right? The car is not going to walk that exact distance. It's not going to drive for that exact distance. So if you calculate the distance and the force, you measure the work done to move it from point A to point B, it's not going to be exactly equal to all of the energy that was included in the gasoline, because the process of combustion itself will waste heat and will waste noise. And that noise and that heat takes up some of the energy. And there's friction and all kinds of other mechanisms for loss will mean that you'll never get a 100% efficient engine. There's never been an engine that's 100% efficient. So you do, however, have a clear idea of how much energy is included in that tank of gasoline. So we know that this tank of gasoline can do this many, that has this much joules inside it. And theoretically, if we did have the 100% efficient engine, we know that this is how much output we could have gotten out of this gasoline. So then that's a useful benchmark against which to compare engines, because then, you know, you're never going to hit 100, but 100 is a very useful metric against which you can compare all of the other engines, all of the engines to one another. So this engine is 74% efficient, that one is 62% efficient, that one is 55% efficient. That's a very useful calculation because, again, there is a constant, there is a unit. You're comparing it to something. You know, you're comparing it to a measure of the energy that is included in the gasoline. And the amount of energy that is included in the gasoline is something that you can measure based on units that are very strictly defined and that are accessible for anybody in the world. So we know, you know, the joule is a function of, is a unit that is measured by measuring weight and temperature and distance. There's all these factors that go into it. Each one of them has a unit of measurement, which is, again, very well defined. So we know what a meter is, we know what a second is, and we know what speed is, and we know how to calculate speed as a meter per second and acceleration as meter per second squared. We know how to calculate temperature. From all of that, we can figure out the energy, and then from that, we can figure out the efficiency. So we can tell this engine is 52% efficient, that engine is 54% efficient. Because there is a very clear metric against which we're measuring. There's a very clear ruler we're measuring it against. And that's what economics does not have. So for me, the concept of efficiency in economics doesn't make sense. For me, it's a category error to talk about markets as being efficient, because what are they efficient compared to? It's really an example of the sloppy thinking of economists in the 20th century and the physics envy. So in the 20s and 30s, economics was basically taken over by failed physicists and mathematicians who implemented what was being done in math and physics into economics, with the idea that we could turn economics into a science similar to physics, and then we could manage and run people's lives, because we can make plans and we can make calculations, just like with physics, you know. So with physics, you figure out the engine's efficiency, you try out different ways of organizing the engine, and then you figure out which one is more efficient, and then you choose the one that's most efficient. Well, why don't we do the same thing with economic production? We get our smart scientists to look at the world and understand how the world works, smart economic scientists, to look at the world and understand how the world works. And then they'll figure out what is the more efficient way of organizing economic production. And then we basically use the loving guns of the state to incentivize people toward the right kind of behavior in order to make things more efficient for them. That's kind of the thinking that was behind the physics envy of economics. So economics was constructed similar to physics. And if you look, there's an entire study that was done, I forget the name of the author. I'll probably look it up a little bit later and dig it up. But a whole study that was done on how economics is essentially, how modern economics was constructed based on physics. And then it shows you the thinking process of the economists who are doing it, and it maps it onto physics, physics, and shows you the parallels, you know, thinking about GDP as energy, and thinking about ways of increasing the energy. So all of this terminology of thinking of markets as being efficient, I think it is inapplicable in my mind, because efficiency implies efficiency necessarily implies an optimum. And efficiency is a measure of deviation from the optimum. But in society, in economics, in economic production, there's no way of objectively determining what is an optimum. So there's no way of figuring out what makes for the most efficient way of organizing this society. So you've got a country of 10 million people. You don't have a way of figuring out what is the most efficient way of making those 10 million people produce the most value. I'm not saying that you can't do it because you're not good at it, and because you don't have enough math skills. You can't do it because how do you measure most utility? You cannot calculate the utility for everybody else. You have to calculate, you can only calculate the utility for yourself. Value is subjective for everyone else. There's no metric for measuring things. There's no way of calculating things objectively so that we can then allocate resources and division of labor based on the one that gives us the most utility, because, you know, utility is not comparable between people. I can't tell you that this thing, me having one thing, is worth more than you having something, because, again, there's no unit to compare them to. So without the unit, I don't think the entire concept of efficiency applies. So that's why I don't think it's useful to talk about markets being efficient, because it's in fact counterproductive, because it gives statists the illusion that, well, if markets are efficient, then, you know, there is an optimum, and maybe markets are not entirely efficient. Maybe we can increase the efficiency. And in my mind, I think it's more correct to just completely reject the premise that there is an optimum, and efficiency is a measure of how far we are from this optimum. Now, having said that, there is some kernel of very valuable insight in the efficient market hypothesis, in the sense that it's a way of helping us understand how the market process works, in that, yes, when, let's say, there is a market out there for a commodity, and then people figure out, you know, news comes out that something happened, and people immediately can interpret it as, this is going to be bad for this industry. So for instance, an airplane crashes, and immediately, you know, as soon as people start hearing about this, people realize, well, that's not going to be good for this airline company, and that's not going to be good for this aircraft maker. And so as soon as people hear about this, they immediately start selling their stocks in that company, because they anticipate that is the price is going to drop, and they want to sell before it has its full drop. So in that sense, you can see them, like, I think there's value in thinking about that. I don't think it's productive to use the term efficiency. I think you know, dynamism or responsiveness are better indication of what we're trying to get at from this, in that markets are dynamic, in that they're constantly incorporating information. You know, the airplane crashes, and then immediately one guy calls his broker and says, sell all of my stock in this airline or this airplane maker. So the market is internalizing that information, and immediately it's, you know, people start selling the stock, and then you immediately start finding that the value of the stock is declining. You'll be getting this happening constantly. I think the way to think about market process is, and Hayek mentions this, you know, it's not very useful to think about equilibrium. And one of the problems in economics today is that they do think of this thing called equilibrium when they should instead be thinking about the process of equilibrium, or the equilibrating process. It's not that markets arrive at equilibrium. It's that markets are constantly in a place of equilibrating. There's never an equilibrium. There's never a perfect point that they get to where, you know, things are sorted and everything is fixed. It's always a process wherein if the supply exceeds the demand, then the price drops. If the demand exceeds the supply, then the price rises. And so the price is constantly oscillating to reflect all the extra information that is coming in. I find the topic of efficiency to be counterproductive to thinking of this, again, because it makes it look like there is an optimum. But having said all that, Bitcoin is really, you know, again, this is Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde in economics. Having said all that, Bitcoin offers us the first metric in economics, the first constant in economics. So now we know that one Bitcoin is always going to be equal to 1/21,000,000 of all of the Bitcoins that exist in this network. And that's something that we've never had before. We've never been able to look at a liquid asset and say, this is X out of Y of the total supply. There's only ever going to be Y, and X is the most that we have. So I think this is going to have massive implications going forward. If Bitcoin continues to grow, Bitcoin continues to become more and more important as part of the world economy, more of the world economy becomes mathematically tractable, in a sense, because now we can keep, we do have a meter equivalent now, because just like what we were mentioning with the earlier example of the fridge between China and Brazil and the US, there was no economic constant between China and Brazil and the US, but now there is. You know, people in China and Brazil and the US know that one Satoshi is one out of 2.1 quadrillion Satoshis, and that's it. And there's never going to be any change about that. So it'll be interesting to see whether that ends up vindicating or allowing for a lot of the mathematical finance that we've seen pop up over the last couple of decades, or last several decades, if that gets a new lease of life with Bitcoin, because things end up being so much easier to calculate, because now we have a constant metric, which is how much Bitcoin there is. We're not at the point yet where we could see any of this reflected in thinking about general economic factors, because Bitcoin is still way too small over the entire world market. But we see it in the Bitcoin market itself, like the ability of the Bitcoin price to continue to match the expectations from the stock to flow model is, in my mind, absolutely amazing. And I think it's why it's what drives me to suspect that this is indeed the first constant in economics, because we see it now in Bitcoin, but maybe we'll start seeing it in other parts of economic calculation. Does that answer your question, Max?
We can talk about commensurability or something like that. But in the end, if this effect gets reflected in many parts of the market, I mean, the market is still not efficient in the strict sense, but so long as we have that constant, everything can be measured against everything else in a more, quote unquote, efficient way.
Yeah.
But of course, we need to, I mean, there's a long way to go.
The dystopian scenario here is that Bitcoin ends up allowing social calculation to happen, and then because of that, you know, Mises' critique of socialism stops working, because now we have Bitcoin and the socialists can just do all of their calculations with Bitcoin. It would be horrifying. But let's wake up from that nightmare and see. Marquita, what do you want to ask?
Well, so my question was around, I know you mentioned Bitcoin could be the first economic constant, but is there anyone else, you know, maybe talking about that? Or, yeah, well, now that you just said that, maybe it would be scary if someone put all that together. It was just a hypothetical. Is anyone else talking about it aside from stock to flow charts that seem to predict really well?
I haven't heard anybody else talk about it as far as I can tell. I'm not sure if any of you, anybody else here has heard of anybody. Have you?
The syllabus for my new online economics course, Principles of Economics, is now available on saifeddin.com. The course will take place over 18 lectures, each based on one chapter from my new book, Principles of Economics, which will be available for free as an ebook for everyone registering for the course. Lectures will be released once every 2 weeks on Mondays, starting on the 25th of September, 2023, and will be available in video and audio format. Live discussion seminars will be held once a week on Thursdays at alternating time slots, 12 hours apart, to ensure learners can attend from all over the world. I'm happy to announce that I have set up my new publishing house and online bookstore, The Safe House, which will be publishing and delivering the best Bitcoin and Austrian economics books worldwide in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook formats. Go to thesafehouse.com to buy my latest book, Principles of Economics, as well as the Fiat Standard and the Bitcoin Standard. And now I'm also publishing Fiat Food, Matthew Lisiak's amazing investigation into how inflation ruined our diet and health. And I'm also publishing Lynn Alden's Broken Money, her masterful exploration of the failures of the global financial system and how Bitcoin fixes it. This is a Bitcoiner's bookshop, so the books are printed in beautiful cloth hardcover made to last, with an ice-colored dust jacket on top. Go to thesafehouse.com and get yours now.
Now, I watch the Mises Institute and Lou Rockwell, those people a lot, and I don't hear any of them talking about it.
I see. Yeah, I think this started really in my course, Economics 12, which is available on the website. In that course, I decided that for the last lecture, I was going to focus on Bitcoin and Austrian economics. And for that, you know, I really sat down and started to think about what the stock to flow model means for Austrian economics. And one way that I could reconcile it, it came to me while trying to prepare this lecture, I remember, was that, well, you know, Mises says we can't have mathematical economics because we don't have constants. We don't have units. This is the thing. This is what it ultimately comes down to. Many misconceptions about why we can't have central planning work, but ultimately it comes down to the fact that you can't calculate because there's no unit for measuring economic value. There's no objective unit for economic value. And so based on that, the only way that you can perform economic calculations is if you have them done at the individual level. And I'm not sure if Mises has stated it this way, but the way that I think about it, the reason that individualism works, the reason that individual economic activities work, or individual economic calculation works to allocate resources efficiently, is that when you're calculating for yourself, you are the only constant. You are the constant in that relationship. So that you put yourself as a constant, and then you look at all the variables in the world, all the prices and the quantities and all the economic variables around you, and you weigh the utility, the relative utility of different courses of action against one constant, which is you, your own well-being and happiness. And so that's why it's possible to make these calculations when you have the constant being you, your own well-being, which you only can judge. And that can't be done on a, this is why I think this is why I don't think this is a threat. I don't think socialism would work even if Bitcoin turned out to be the first constant in economics, because ultimately the thing that we solve for in economics is individual utility. There's no way of solving individual utility collectively. So even if we get a measure of value that is objective, there's no way of determining what is better for you except your own judgment and your own calculation. And so a central authority won't be able to determine what's better for you.
You've argued that you don't see a quick demise of fiat currency. As a matter of fact, it may continue unabated in terms of using it for transactions, if I understand you correctly. Given the discussion you just had, I'm trying to reason in my mind the new role of fiat. Would that be fair, given Bitcoin as a sidekick? For instance, I'm working on building a house right now. We're in the early stages. And this morning, I realized that I've completely quit pricing the house in fiat currency. I'm thinking of it totally in Bitcoin. I have X amount of Bitcoin, and I have Y amount that I refuse to spend. So I've got Z amount that I'm willing to commit to a home build. And I look at the prices of land and the changes in lumber prices, and copper are all just going crazy in fiat. I look at it in terms of how many Bitcoin I'm willing to spend, and I catch myself disregarding those numbers, which caused me to start thinking about your argument regarding fiat currencies not just fading overnight.
I think it's a gradual process that eventually starts happening more and more with Bitcoiners. The more familiar you are with Bitcoin and the Bitcoin price and the value of Bitcoin, and then eventually the value of a Satoshi, you do start thinking of the world in terms of Bitcoins. And so you start measuring things in terms of Satoshis. And I think, as we mentioned last week in the seminar, when we were talking about bonds, like the Satoshi rate is going to start becoming more and more probably of a replacement of the risk-free rate. Because in a sense, think of now that you've been bitten by the Bitcoin bug, you will always, you're always going to be liable to one day look back at the house that you built and think, well, when I started, this is how many Bitcoins this thing was worth. And then this is how many Bitcoins it was worth at the end. And, you know, you're going to start measuring the opportunity cost in terms of Bitcoin. Bitcoin is going to teach the whole world the opportunity cost in terms of Satoshis. So effectively, I think you're touching on something profound here, which is that once you see the Bitcoins and you see how valuable they are and you see how reliable they're there for you, whereas everything else is, you know, tenuously linked to you and you never know when you might wake up and see it gone, then Bitcoin really becomes your unit of account and your unit of measurement, and you start thinking in its terms. I can certainly see that happening, but I don't see how that necessarily means that that is going to kill fiat. So I think it might really be the case that, you know, you look at dysfunctional hyperinflationary economies where there is hyperinflation and the currency is always falling apart. So in all those countries, there's a small minority of the population that lives off of foreign currency, and they deal with each other with foreign currency, and they, you know, they work abroad or they get their money from abroad, and they continue to live on a dollar standard. So there are people in Venezuela living on a dollar standard, and there are people in all of these poor, dysfunctional, inflationary economies that still have dollars and can still trade with dollars. And in their mind, you know, they're measuring things in dollars so that when they go to the supermarket, you know, the prices in their local national shitcoin are always dropping, but they perform the calculation against the dollar. But then there are people in the same country that don't know the dollar, can't touch a single dollar, and have to continue to stumble along with their broken peso shitcoin or lira shitcoin, whatever it is, making calculations with it and messing things up and suffering for it. So, like, I'm not so sure how how you using it as a unit of account is changes what I had been mentioning in the discussion that I, in my view, why it won't collapse for long. I think the case for why it won't collapse for why it will be taking long for it to collapse is just that Bitcoin can continue to grow without fiat money having to die. That, you know, it can continue to drop in price next to the dollar, next to Bitcoin. The Bitcoin price can continue to go up, but national currencies continue to be used, or at least some national currencies continue to be used, even though their price continuously goes down in Bitcoin. A lot of people still get paid in them and they still get raises by the end of the year. they, you know, they can't keep up with inflation and they can't keep up with Bitcoin. But, you know, who knows, maybe they can keep this going for a while. You know, the point that I make is that Bitcoin reduces the demand for the creation of dollars because it reduces the demand for holding debt. And so if you think about it, as we were saying in the seminar on bonds, if the demand for bonds goes away, you know, the demand for people to hold bonds goes away because insurance companies and corporate treasuries, instead of wanting to hold cash, instead of wanting to hold bonds, if they start holding Bitcoin, then there's an enormous decline in the incentive to issue new bonds, which means an enormous decline in the incentive to issue more money. And so more, if there's not going to be more money made, that's not going to be hyperinflationary. So maybe the creation of credit slows down because instead of creating new credit for people to store value in, instead of giving more bonds for people, Bitcoin just appreciates and people hold on to more Bitcoin. So the result in that case is that we don't get runaway hyperinflation. We don't get an increase in the supply of the money. We get the supply of the money staying relatively constant, and the central bank might be able to manage the price level, what they call the price level, to prevent there from significant inflation from happening. But you know, significant price inflation from happening, you know, using the same tricks they've been using all along, which is weigh the basket of goods towards the things that drop in price because of technology. And you know, in that world, maybe we can unwind fiat rather than just witness it collapse. What do you think?
I think the using Bitcoin as a financial measurement constant is absolutely amazing. That whole talk that you did on that really, it had a lot for me because it reminded me of a documentary I saw of how the Egyptians had discovered the size of a centimeter was a drop of water. So that could be reproduced anywhere in the world. You could take a drop of water. It's always 1 centimeter. So 100 of those is 1 meter. And at first that information is concentrated in Egypt. They use it to build all kinds of stuff. And then it's exported all throughout the world where builders, you could see all over the world, were using the meter as a construction measurement tool. And we kind of created all of civilization using that foundational technology. So maybe Bitcoin is the beginning of a new foundational civilization that we're going to create now that we have this constant. So I really enjoyed that. That was great. Thanks.
Thanks, man. Yeah, I think it's an underrated feature of Bitcoin, but I think more and more people are going to come to grapple with it. Most people are still dismissing the stock-to-flow model as if, well, you know, it's just another financial model. But, you know, many of the people dismissing it are dismissing it without even understanding, without even accepting the possibility that it could be correct, even though it's making clear, it's making clear testable predictions. And it would be very easy to reject it once it is wrong, once any of these predictions are wrong. But it continues to make the predictions correctly. And I find that to be absolutely astonishing. And I think it's worth looking into in depth to try and think about just why is it that we can make these predictions with this level of accuracy? We can take a variable that is completely exogenous that was invented before Bitcoin came into existence, the stock to flow of Bitcoin. We've had it planned out since before Bitcoin came into being. And then we take that variable and we plot it against the price, and we see that essentially the relationship is extremely strong and it holds for many, many years. This is really, I think, the best, could be the most mind-blowing thing about Bitcoin. There are others. Maybe I'm exaggerating when I say most. Maybe, you know, closing central banks is a little bit more mind-blowing than this, but for the nerd in me, this is more interesting, I guess.
Was there an updated model yesterday that actually predicts a new high of like 288,000?
Yesterday, I'm not sure that came out yesterday. It's been out for a while. It's the other. So basically, there's the time series model, which is the one that I find the most fascinating, which looks at the stock to flow over time and then predicts the price at time. Then there's this other model that Plan B has made, which is the cross asset model, the stock to flow cross asset. And with this model, he looks at it's not time based, so there's no looking at the time. We correlate the stock to flow to the size of the assets and the assets, the total asset class. And he does that for silver and for gold and for Bitcoin across all of its stages. You know, each monthly price point and stock to flow is a price point, is a point in that regression. And then you add gold and you add silver and real estate. My problem with this, it does give a higher estimate, but I'm not entirely sold. And I prefer the other model because my problem with this one is that the majority of the use of silver is industrial. So silver is an industrial metal. It's not a monetary metal. So the reason there's a price of silver, or a lot of the price of silver, is down to the fact that people are consuming silver in industrial uses. So that's not monetary use. So I don't think you can, you know, I would count the stockpile of silver, the monetary stockpile of silver, to be far smaller than the monetary stockpile of than the total stockpile of silver that's out there. And we've had a discussion about this in one of the earlier podcasts here on stock to flow, and we went into a discussion on, you know, different ways of measuring the stock of silver. So if you count industrial or jewelry silver as being part of the monetary stockpile, then you get a much bigger silver stockpile. But in my mind, you can't really count that. And what you should be counting is just the monetary metal, which can be traded. So that would be gold coins, silver coins and bars. If you calculate it this way, you'll get a much lower stockpile for silver. And then with real estate, similarly, yes, a lot of people use real estate as a store of value, but they also use real estate as a home. So yes, real estate is probably overvalued because a lot of people use it as a saving account. And we probably have far more real estate than we would have in another world if people weren't investing in it so much. But you can't take all of the value of real estate and attribute it to the store of value and then calculate it according to the stock to flow of it. I don't think that is a fair comparison, because just like with silver, a bigger chunk is not used in a monetary capacity. And to a growing extent, this is also the case for gold. So for me, if I were to actually run this model, I'd have lower values for silver and real estate, and then that would bring the results. Well, that effectively takes us back to the same results as the time series, because ultimately the S2FX model, you know, the majority of the data are from the Bitcoin time series, but then you add the silver and the gold and the real estate, and then that skews the results upward. But so if you don't really believe in this data, then you end up back at the original relationship. So that's why I personally, I'm not a big believer in the stock to flow cross asset model. I don't find it as compelling. And also because this is just looking at a correlation that exists rather than, it's much easier to look at S2FX and say correlation, not causation. But with the time series, it's much more difficult to say that, because time series model, we can definitively rule out reverse causation. In other words, we definitively know that it's not going to be the price that's causing the stock to flow to rise, right? That correlation is not spurious, because it's not the price that's causing the stock to flow to rise, because the stock to flow was planned out before the price had ever existed. And so there's no reverse causality. With each month that the data continues to stick to the range of the prediction, it becomes harder and harder to claim that the correlation is spurious. I'm not convinced the same can be said about S2FX, because it's, you're looking at data that's much tougher to verify. You know, who knows how much silver actually there is, or how much real estate there really is, and how you measure it. Whereas with Bitcoin, we know exactly how many Bitcoin there are, and we have very, very good price data. Here in Saifedean.com laboratories, we have long ago diagnosed and explained the phenomena of Bitcoin number go up and identified its underlying technological processes. So it doesn't act as a surprise for us.
What's been the big news this week for you, do you think? Anything caught your mind?
Well, this week, I think, where do we start? I guess, Morgan Stanley, pretty big one.
And did you see Bank of America today putting out the classic climate change FUD?
No, what did they say?
Oh, just the usual crap. It's amazing. You have Morgan Stanley coming out one way, Bank of America coming out the other. And it wasn't big news, but I think it was a nice look into what's coming. There was a company that builds condominiums that are taking Bitcoin onto their balance sheet with the view in the long run to eradicate fees for residents if they can start using the appreciative Bitcoin price to offset that, which I think was a pretty cool little article, which didn't make huge headlines. I did retweet it out, but I think it kind of flew under the radar.
How is that going to work exactly? What are they going to? So it's a rental or what is it?
Hang on, let me find it, because if you guys missed it, it was kind of interesting. The SEC have just admitted they've dug themselves into a hole by not allowing in a Bitcoin ETF, which is also quite interesting.
The Bitcoin ETF problem is going to be solved, as Michael Saylor explained, by Bitcoin miners and companies like MicroStrategy essentially playing that role. I think at this point, it's almost like they've twisted the SEC's arms into needing to approve an ETF, because think about the model for a mining company. You know, all you got to do is just run the mining equipment and list on the stock exchange, and then your stock is basically Bitcoin. And so investors who just want access to a reliable store of value to hold value into the future can just buy your stock. Well, obviously, it's not as good as Bitcoin, but it's the closest that they'll get to having Bitcoin's glorious number go up technology applied. So it looks like we're going to be seeing more and more of that, more mining companies listing on the stock market and companies like MicroStrategy basically taking on Bitcoin on the balance sheet and becoming a financial instrument that is almost a proxy for Bitcoin. I think we're going to be seeing more and more of this.
Yeah. I put that chat, the link in the chat about this condominium company, that condominium corporation, that are going to start investing into Bitcoin. Like I said, it's not huge amounts, but it's these things need to start happening, right? For more and more companies to feel that they clearly feel that risk is off. And I think as the rest of the year plays out and we get some more announcements from big institutions, more and more of these small to medium size enterprises are going to start doing the same.
Yeah.
Speaking of that, we've been seeing news like this every week, new companies, big companies, not so big companies, even small companies like pizza places down the corner and all that, which is great. But something that is happening also is companies putting Ethereum in the balance sheet. I mean, we can't stop them. They do whatever they want to do, right? But I know it's up to this point is just mere speculation, but what can we expect from this? What the consequences might be for the following two cycles or so? So shitcoinery is now an institutional thing.
I think the consequence is always going to be the same. You know, when you play stupid games, you win stupid prizes. That's always been the case. It's only really, I think, it's just one company that I've heard that has bought Ethereum. And it's a gaming company or something like that. Or it's a company that does something related to Ethereum one way or the other. I don't think it's
I've heard of more than one company, like three or four so far.
Yeah.
Different amounts. The thing is, okay, they do what they can have fun staying poor. I mean, I don't care. The point is that if many companies do this, the so-called wall of money going into Bitcoin is not going to be as big as we wished. It's going to take longer.
I'm not so sure. I don't think so. I think, you know, the private companies can have the ability to put money into shitcoins, but you know, serious money with publicly traded companies and with large financial institutions, you know, there are guidelines and standards that they have to adhere to before they can put their money into something. And so something like putting it into Bitcoin has taken them a very long time. And there is a case that can be made. Like, ultimately, there is a clear case for why Bitcoin can maintain its scarcity and why Bitcoin is not going to have more than 21 million coins. And I think serious investors who want to allocate serious money are going to think about, you know, it's a very important question to ask. Well, why can't they just make more Bitcoin? Well, if you ask that question about Bitcoin within, you know, if you come at Bitcoin with that question, you can arrive at a very good answer for it. You can see the case for why there's not going to be more than 21 million Bitcoins, why the supply is not going to be changed. And you can actually explain it to somebody and you can have pretty good confidence in it. But if you try to make the same case with any of the other coins, you can't. Like, there's no way that you can make it to somebody serious, that you can just explain to them what you're trying to convey, that because they themselves don't know how many coins they're going to have. So maybe the supply will go up, maybe the supply will go down. They still don't really know. There's no sclerosis. In Bitcoin, there's a lot of sclerosis, and so there's a lot of certainty. It's, you know, the burden of trying to change out what you could, how you can do this yourself, you know, how you would be able to be the one to make Bitcoin supply change. And with the shitcoins, on the other hand, you can't say that. You can't do that. You cannot make this claim because they've been hard forked, and it's pretty trivial to hard fork them. And the supply can be changed. And you're counting on the politics of this obscurely defined group of people constantly being in sync in a way that plays to the advantage of your portfolio. And that's just, you know, I'm sure there are people out there who are going to have fun with this kind of allocation, but it's not something that is going to, not something that's going to massively dent the amount of money that's going to go into Bitcoin at all, I think. Because, like, with the real big size of money coming in, the majority of it is not held by people who are going to be hoodwinked by thinking about things like, oh, wow, this is great. You know, we don't know how many Ethereums there are and we don't know how many there are going to be. But, you know, look at all the CryptoKitties that they have, or look at all this. They're going to reinvent contracts on the blockchain. They're going to revolutionize the world of screenshots on the blockchain. And, you know, well, great. But you're not going to stick your company's treasury onto this high school project level security. As we said in the episode and in the seminar we called the shitcoin standard, the shitcoins are dilutive of shitcoins. They're not dilutive of Bitcoin. So the companies that will put money into Ethereum will also put money into other shitcoins as well, into, you know, the new Ethereum and the Ethereum 2.0, which is EOS, which does everything that Ethereum does, but better, which is basically nothing. Or the other better Ethereum, which is, well, let's not give them free advertisement, but, you know, other, you know, if you fall for one, you'll fall for the other. You don't have the level of sophistication where you're going to really kick the tires and question the premise of digital scarcity that gives Bitcoin its value. And you think that Ethereum can have its value, you're also going to fall for other shitcoins. Like, there are no shitcoin maximalists who can make a convincing case for why only their shitcoin matters and none of the other ones matter. Because why should it matter and not the other ones? Well, the only one that's truly unique is Bitcoin. So Bitcoin continues to take the lion's share of the serious money, and then the rest of them fight over the scraps. And the more of them there are, the fewer scraps there is for each one of them. And the less and the bigger the gap grows between them and Bitcoin.
On any of the trainings or presentations that I've read, where the institutions are either offering information for Bitcoin or direct exposure to Bitcoin. They say, you know, they don't prefer any particular digital currency, but they don't talk about any other one except Bitcoin in their presentations, in their trainings, and the material they're using to solicit their high net worth, you know, individuals or the institution. So I think it's more confusing to new folks like myself to try to understand that, because you don't understand that Bitcoin actually has value in the first place. I understand it now, but I didn't. I really didn't. I just thought it was a fun, you know, risky, speculative thing to do to try to make some money real quick. And that's really the mindset of maybe the less sophisticated trader or someone without money. But I think the serious money, which is going to hopefully, or so we think, will hopefully stabilize the market or take us to that $2 trillion and beyond. I think there's no question.
Yeah, and I gotta say, like, this is also independent of whether they realize it or not. In other words, even if institutional money happens to be indifferent between Bitcoin and shitcoins, the economic reality of it, like I say in the Bitcoin standard, when you apply that to looking at gold and silver and other currencies, ultimately, gold didn't even need anybody to go out there and actively want to monetize it. People could have chosen their monetary metals completely randomly, and we would still have ended up with gold winning. You know, if let's say we had four monetary metals, gold, silver, bronze, and iron, and by law, it was decreed that everybody had to put 25% of their wealth in each one of those four. Or if by some accident of history, it was determined that, you know, 25% of people will put in each one of them. And so a quarter of the wealth will go to each one. In the end, it's going to still end up being gold with the vast majority of the market share, because the other currencies, the other metals will be diluted much faster. So every year, silver increases by 10, 20, 30%. The stockpiles of silver can increase by 10, 20, 30%. Copper increases much faster and iron increases much faster. So the end result is more people keep putting money into copper and silver, more copper and silver gets made and iron, and the price of copper and silver declines. And then you end up with the price of gold not declining as much because far less gold can be made. And so the economic reality imposes itself at the end, and gold ends up becoming the one that's most valuable, even if people are completely unaware of this. And I think something similar would happen with Bitcoin and shitcoins, whereas the shitcoins themselves, if they were to grow in value as much as Bitcoin was to grow, we'll see attempts to inflate the supply. We're going to start seeing things come up that are going to ask for an increase in the supply, like what happened with the DAO hack with Ethereum. When the people who can hard fork Ethereum lost a lot of money, they hard forked Ethereum. And, you know, there will be occasions like that, where there's going to be a fractional reserve banking system run on top of it, and then it's going to come crashing down, and they're going to need coins for the bailout. And guess what? If we hard fork, we can bail them out. And you can see how these scenarios would imagine. So if one of these things is to monetize and it's continued to grow, the pressure to print more of it will show. So even if those institutional investors don't realize that they're buying a bag of shitcoin, you don't have to realize that you've bought shit in order for you to not enjoy it. You know, even if you fool yourself into thinking that it is a delicious ribeye steak, it's still going to poison you because it is shit. So they put all of this money, these things rise in value. There's going to be pressure on the people behind them for one reason or the other to print more of these coins. And these coins can not withstand that pressure. There will be a way to hard fork them. And then there's going to be more of them that are going to be made if push were to come to shove. So, you know, the question is, do we do this the easy way, where the big money understands and stays away from the shitcoins, and the shitcoins remain small, And, you know, it continues to be a small group of suckers that continuously get, there's always a new group of suckers that go in and get fleeced by the shitcoiners. That relatively continues to become a smaller fraction of Bitcoin as Bitcoin continues to grow. Or we could do this the hard way, where the institutions go and play stupid games, and then we're going to have a lot of fun over the next few years. As you know, it'll be fun to see Microsoft go bankrupt because of an Ethereum hard fork. you know, it's if they insist on doing it this way, then who's to stop them?
What happens to fiat currency? Does specifically the U.S. dollar, like, does fiat currency survive that, the closing of central banks, that fantasy and possibly reality?
Actually, the best thing that could happen to the U.S. dollar is, or any fiat currency, is the closing of the central bank behind it. And this isn't just speculation. We have a very compelling evidence that this was the case. It's well known in Iraq during the U.S. invasion. At that time, I think the exchange rate between the Iraqi dinar and the U.S. dollar was around 5,000 dinars per dollar. And then when the U.S. Air Force bombed the Iraqi central bank and destroyed it, within a few weeks, I think, the price, the exchange rate had dropped, or the exchange rate of the Iraqi dinar had risen, and the dollar had dropped next to it, and you could get 2,000 to 3,000 Iraqi dinars for the dollar. So it was almost like a doubling in value of the Iraqi dinar by this one simple trick of destroying the Iraqi central bank. Now, quiz time, why might we think that would be the case?
Right, maybe I'm asking the wrong question, because clearly it would harden any currency, right, to remove all of those tricks that are being used. So what does it really destroy then? Because it makes the currency stronger. It's the system that gets hopefully trashed.
Yeah, but so yeah, the system got trashed. So like I presume, you know, if you had the deposits at an Iraqi bank, then things probably weren't looking great for your chances of redeeming them when the central bank was taken out. But the physical cash appreciated in value simply because it became quite credible to not expect the supply to increase for a while, because the central bank is out of commission and the government has been removed, and it's going to be a while before they print more currency. But also, when they're going to print new currency, it's going to definitely be new, different from the old one. The old one had Saddam Hussein's ugly mug on all of them. And so when the new government was going to print dinars or the new currency, they were not going to have the same currencies. So you had a very good and reliable mechanism for ensuring the scarcity of the Iraqi dinar after the central bank was destroyed. You knew that this was not going to be destroyed. Whereas before the raid on the central bank happened, you know, 5 minutes before that, a big part of the price of the dinar was, you know, the reason that it was continuously devaluing. A part of it was down to the fact that people expected the central bank to keep printing. It had been printing for the past 10, 15, 20 years or so, and they had expected the printing to continue to go on. And so, you know, you had trouble getting people to hold the Iraqi dinars because they expected that next month there's going to be a lot more printing. But then when you take out the central bank, there's not going to be much printing left. And so the paper money appreciated in value. I think there's a lesson there. And really, the only problem stopping the market from having free market money is just the existence of central banks. Like, it's just the fact that they're constantly manipulating the market that prevents the market from having it. Because otherwise, you know, their own, it's astounding when you think about it. You know, the own crappy central bank paper becomes good money once you break the printer. You know, the market will make do with Saddam Hussein dinars, hyperinflationary dinars with Saddam Hussein's picture on them, even after Saddam Hussein has been removed from power, the market can still make do with that piece of paper and still make a monetary system out of it. This is just how ingenious and resourceful markets are. This thing naturally gains a bigger monetary premium when people know that it's not going to be devalued and they can use it. So, you know, if they didn't rebuild the central bank, then they wouldn't have stuck to these papers forever. They would have probably transitioned to something else eventually, but they would have been perfectly capable of transitioning to something else. It's just the market will find a way. Whatever is the hardest will get used as money and it will be accepted. And people will want it because it's what makes trading easier.
Well, and we're taking cash out, right? Cash is coming out of the system. Certainly in the US it is. So you don't have paper money soon. I mean, that's what they're trying to do, right? They keep talking about there's a coin shortage, which just means they want to remove cash so that everything can be tracked. And doesn't that change the equation a little bit? This is also speculative, but if there is not paper money to fall back on in that situation.
Yeah, I mean, if there's no paper money in a central bank that gets taken out, then... Yeah, sorry for your loss. Venmo is not going to be working without a central bank behind it. I'm not sure this is in any sense in the fiat world likely that we're going to be rid of central banks anytime soon.
Yeah,
I think they're getting started now. They're gonna probably introduce something like a digital currency that allows them, yeah, as you said, more surveillance, more control and more inflation and less saving. Like they're going to make it impossible for anybody to save. So everybody has to keep working for the last second of their life because, you know, even as an 89-year-old, if you stop working for 15 minutes, your savings disappear and you die. So Peter, better get back to work.
Hi, Saif. I'm curious if you know about Lebanon. Did Bitcoin come more into use there as a standard for holding its value, and what are people trading with? Because there was a run on the banks and limitation to how much people could withdraw.
Yeah, well, I just yesterday actually I ran the numbers on the Lebanese lira and Bitcoin, and since in the last 2 years, so over the last 2 years, the Bitcoin price in the Lebanese lira has gone up 140-fold. And it's a lot. And the price has increased insanely highly. So Bitcoin use is growing massively. I remember, you know, a couple of years ago, there was very few people talking about Bitcoin. Now, a lot of people have had to use it. And, you know, if you want to send money into the country, if you do it through the banks, you might not get it. And the banks might cash out the money at the old exchange rate. So you get it at a much lower price than you would get it from the market. A lot of people have started cashing out their money with Bitcoin, and it's worked out very well for them. And a lot of people, well, not a lot, unfortunately, overall, you know, not a significant percentage of the population, but, you know, several, many people, maybe hundreds, probably thousands even, of people have, you know, accumulated some savings in Bitcoin, and it's saved their lives, saved their financial lives. You know, they would have been destitute otherwise. This is really a sad thing to say, but it's looking, you know, this is the ugly model for Bitcoin adoption, which we're seeing, which is that people don't get Bitcoin and they keep asking stupid questions about, you know, but what if it gets hacked? And but without the central bank, who will guarantee the value of my Bitcoins? Because, you know, my lira is guaranteed by the central bank, and look how well that worked out. Like, people keep asking those questions as long as they can afford to ask those questions. But then there comes a point when you can't afford to ask them anymore, when all of your lira's value is gone. And at that point, if you still have some wealth, you could convert it to Bitcoin. But I think for a lot of people, we're going to see the sad reality is Bitcoin would have been, let's say, 0.01 of the total wealth of Lebanon 2 years ago, because very few people owned Bitcoin compared to all the other kinds of assets that people own. Well, all the other assets have been discounted. You know, all the lira and dollar denominated assets at the banks have been discounted by 80-90% so far. And so now suddenly Bitcoin is a much bigger chunk of the wealth of the Lebanese people. Bitcoin's gone up about tenfold during this time. and the lira has gone down more than 90%. So combined, you know, the total amount of Bitcoin out there in circulation might today be 1% of the wealth of the Lebanese. I'm just putting these numbers out of my guesstimates. But the important thing is not the magnitude of the number. The important thing is that the percentage of wealth in Lebanon that is in Bitcoin has probably gone up at least 100-fold over the last 2 years, because all the other wealth has been destroyed and the Bitcoin has appreciated. So I think, again, doing it the hard way is you don't adopt Bitcoin and the value of the Bitcoins, the value of your other shitcoins goes to zero. And then your country ends up on a Bitcoin standard just because the few people who have Bitcoin are the only people who maintain their wealth. And then things continue to head in that direction. You know, obviously at some point, the more this happens, the more likely people are to start getting into Bitcoin rather than asking stupid questions and, you know, coming up with all their big galaxy brain takes about no, but it can't work because it's volatile, and no, it can't work because it has a central, doesn't have a central bank or whatever. It's economic reality and it's brutal. It's sad to see a lot of these people get lost in these stupid, really mental masturbation exercises of you know, and I've spent years arguing with people and trying to talk to people, and I've spent years getting laughed at by people for bringing up Bitcoin. And, you know, they'll come up with all these little thought substitutes. Oh, no, but, China's going to ban it. China's going to take control of it, and then they're going to inflate it. And, oh, well, you know, it's too volatile for it to work. So obviously, I'm not going to buy any because, you know, I prefer to lose all of my wealth steadily without much volatility with my local central bank.
Or to be on the dole and not work and just get the handouts that's happening increasingly now with the whole COVID thing. People are just seem willing to live on whatever share they're given.
And yeah, but Lebanon, you can't do that anymore.
No, not Lebanon.
Yeah, like there, the handouts aren't enough to live off of. Very, very few people are able to live off of. And it's also sad, but like, you know, again, in Lebanon, you know, the reason, the ultimate reason behind this entire collapse is that the central bank lends the government. And the government is essentially run by a bunch of corrupt militias that use it in order to milk it for money. The public sector is just a giant cesspool of waste. Everything there, you know, it consumes a shit ton of money and it all goes to waste. Everybody who works in the public sector in Lebanon doesn't even have to turn up to work. They just get paid. Most people don't turn up to work. Most public sector employees don't actually turn up to work. They just get paid. They don't get turned up. They don't even have to turn up, and nobody cares. Nobody asks. There's no accountability, nothing. So these people have really, you know, essentially, they've destroyed the savings and the banking system and the currency in order to continue to support the government, continue to spend its money. And so in 2019, you know, that's when they needed to start printing. And since then, they've tripled the money supply, more than tripled. They've quadrupled, I think, the money supply since then. Just by pure physical printing, it's almost admirably retro. You know, just actually cranking out the printers, and everybody finds a lot of new bills in their hands, and then the value of the currency starts dropping for some reason. But you know, you like there's the easy way of doing this, which is reform the public sector and kick out all of these parasites that get their salaries and produce nothing, and protect the currency. Or there's a difficult way of achieving the same result, which is just watch the currency get collapsed, and then you get to the point where the people who work in the government, you know, their salaries aren't worth anything anyway, because they're getting very small salaries from the devaluation of the currency. And so it seems like this is where they're headed right now. It's sad.
Just waiting for that $1.9 trillion stimulus to come through the Bitcoin from the U.S.
Yeah. The U.S. doing its part in pumping our bags. Thank you, Americans. keep putting those stimmy checks into Bitcoin. It's the only thing that can work.
I have one question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Saifedean, will you come to Bitcoin Miami?
I'm not planning on it, unfortunately, no. I don't think I'm going to be there, no. Would have loved to hang out with Bitcoiners again, but, you know, the world is a little too crazy to be getting on too many airplanes these days.
Yes.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Well, we're we made our on our sailboat all the way to Florida, so.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
That's
so
good.
We'll be going. Yeah.
That's good. That's fun. Enjoy.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, guys. Well, I guess this is it for today. I will see you in our next seminar. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you.